Josh Block is a communications, foreign policy, and political strategist who's been involved in national politics and policy for the last 20 years. A former Clinton administration official and spokesman at the State Department's U.S. Agency for International Development, Block got his start on Capitol Hill in the office of Senator Edward Kennedy and Democratic politics. A spokesman for the Clinton-Gore and Gore-Lieberman presidential campaigns, Block also worked on House and Senate races, including Senator Chuck Schumer's first campaign for the U.S. Senate. After nearly a decade on the senior staff of AIPAC, where he was spokesman and director of strategic communications, Block was appointed senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., and established a strategic consulting practice focused on the intersection of policy, politics, and public affairs for international and U.S.-based clients in the public and private sectors. Block was named by the Foreign Policy magazine to its Twitterati 100 list of the most influential foreign policy experts on Twitter, and he was named by the Forward to its list of the 50 most influential Jews. When he was appointed president and CEO of the Israel Project in 2012, AIPAC President Michael Kasson said, "The Israel's project, as well as the pro-Israel community, will benefit greatly from Josh Block's unique ability to shape the debate and educate both policymakers and the public about Israel and the Middle East." Josh, of course, has a special connection with Beth Am. He is the son of our Rabbi Emeritus, Rick and Susie Block. And it is a great pleasure, Josh, to welcome you back to Beth Am. You're allowed to applaud.
Which one of these is live? All right, they're all on. Hi, everybody. Shabbat Shalom. It is really an honor to be here. First, let me thank Rabbi Martyr and the clergy for being so welcoming. And, of course, the host committee of tonight's event, Helene and Joanne and others who made this event possible. I'm really grateful to you guys. And it's beautiful to see so many friends in the audience, so many people who've played such a sustaining role in my life and the life of my family here in this congregation. It's really special to be here. I also want to acknowledge my colleague, Cameron Parker, who's here with me tonight. Cameron's wearing a bright yellow tie. He's a proud member of AEPI. I'm really honored to be here, and I hope that we can begin a conversation with you. And I promise that I will talk about media and answer whatever questions you guys have tonight. And I look forward to having that conversation. I thought, you know, my father always had a long tradition of starting with a joke. And I figure if I started with one, maybe it won't really eat into my time. It's a story not of this congregation, you can be sure, but a rabbi retires and leaves and goes off into the sunset, and his successor takes over. And in the congregation, a dispute breaks out between two congregants. And one insists that the congregation has always stood at Yizkor for the Kaddish. And another says, no, what are you talking about? We've never done it that way. Never. No one can settle the dispute. So what are the rest? Well, I'll call my predecessor and I'll figure it out. So he calls his predecessor, who's now in the home for retired rabbis who've no longer thought about all these things. And he says, "Listen, Rabbi, I really need your help. These guys, they're coming to me with this conference, this controversy, and no one seems to be able to help sort out the tradition. And can you tell me, did we stand? Did we sit? What did we do?" And the rabbi stops and he thinks, and he says, "I'm sorry, Rabbi, I wish I could help you. I just can't remember." And he says, "Listen, Rabbi, I really need your help. Please think harder. They're eating my kishkas out." And he says, "Now that I remember." Now, I'm sure that wasn't a conversation about this congregation, since it's so wonderful. But it is a great opportunity to remember about the dynamics that exist in our community and the way we look at the world. And it leads me to a bit of our conversation. So first, let me ask tonight, what do you think of these days when you hear the word anti-Semitism? For most of us, it's a pretty reflexive tendency to think about the anti-Semitism we recall, something propagated by the right, the alt-right, white supremacy, the Ku Klux Klan, neo-Nazi groups. The version of anti-Semitism that was on full display in the violent protest that rocked Charlottesville last year. For us, for many of us, Charlottesville was like muscle memory. We'd seen it before, not in many decades perhaps, but we knew what it meant. Unfortunately, that kind of anti-Semitism is making a comeback. And while it may not be new, what is new and what disturbs me is the way this kind of hate has moved beyond the radical fringes increasingly into the mainstream. And just in case anyone doubts what I mean, let me share a few examples. By a show of hands, who in the room has heard of Russell Walker? Russell Walker is noteworthy for a couple of reasons. His recent statement that God is a white supremacist and that all Jews descended from Satan. The second fact, he just won the GOP primary to run for a seat in North Carolina's state house with 65% of the vote. How about Steve West? Anyone heard of Steve West? Steve West hosts a YouTube channel where he says Hitler was right, that the Jewish cabals harvest baby parts for Planned Parenthood. Mr. West just won the GOP primary for a seat in the Missouri State House by more than 25 points. Then there's John Fitzgerald, maybe a name that may be more familiar. He's here in California. He's a Republican. He received 23% of the vote to finish second in the June primary for the 11th Congressional District. For those who don't know the boundaries, it's just down here in Contra Costa County. Fitzgerald's qualification for the state's general election makes him the latest in a series of high-profile extremists across the country, including Art Jones, a Holocaust denier described as a Nazi by the Illinois Republican Party, who renounced him. Meanwhile, in Wisconsin, another white nationalist anti-Semite is running for Paul Ryan's vacated seat. Now, while all of us are disgusted by these developments, they don't really produce shock and awe, honestly. That's mostly, I think, because they fit into a worldview that we've been conditioned to recognize. You know, we recognize the process and the idea that this kind of hatred comes from this direction, and we recognize it when we see it. But what happens when the hatred comes from somewhere unexpected, somewhere much closer to home? What happens when it comes from your friends and your allies and disguised as something else? The Chicago Dyke March is one of several events organized by Chicago's LGBT community and is part of the city's annual Pride Weekend. Last spring, several marchers carrying Pride flags bearing the Star of David were asked to leave the march. The controversy that followed led organizers of the event to issue a statement in which they expressed their reasons. Apparently, the Star of David was, quote, triggering people, making others feel unsafe and threatened. And organizers said the event was intended to be pro-Palestinian. The expelled marchers were accused of disrupting chants by replacing the word Palestine with everywhere. They were talking about justice, justice. They wanted justice everywhere. Oh, and they were, quote, accused of being Zionists. In other words, they demanded equal treatment for Jewish people at an event that prided itself about tolerance. So let's just think about that. The audacity of asking Jews, and only Jews, to renounce their symbols, ladies and gentlemen, obviously that's anti-Semitism. This new form of anti-Semitism, which is being propagated by elements of the alt-left or the left, has a name. I'm talking about a pseudo-academic concept known as intersectionality. For those of you who haven't heard of this before, it's one of the most significant challenges facing our community these days. It's a postmodern worldview. Intersectionality is the radical academic theory that originated really in the 70s that holds that all forms of social oppression are inexorably linked. It's become a code word for anti-American, anti-Western, anti-Israel, anti-Semitic bigotry. Nowhere has the adoption of this radical paradigm been more pronounced than on college campuses, where in the name of identity politics and solidarity, intersectionality has forced artificial coalitions between causes that have little to do with each other, except a perceived hatred for their fellow students who are perceived as privileged because they're white, heterosexual, male, and especially Jewish. The fact to many folks that there is a word, anti-Semitism, to describe the hatred of these white people, us, is confirmation of special power for that group of white people, white privilege. Recently, Kim and I had a fourth kid. Our kids are 12, 10, 7, and 1. Worked out. Two boys and two girls. We were taking Henry to the hospital. He was 5 or 6 days old. We were in the car on the way down and needed to do some minor thing. But to expedite the process, they were taking the intake form over the phone. And they asked ethnicity. So I said, Caucasian. I said, no, 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 other. And she read a long list of other things. You know, I can't even remember what they were. Non-Hispanic, non-African, African, all kinds of different stuff. I said no to all that too. At the end, she said what? And I said Jewish. At the end of the call, my kids asked why I said Jewish. Why did you just say white, Caucasian? I said, well, I think it's important for you to know, for us to recognize, that we're not just a bunch of white people. Our history is different. You know, I said 65 plus years ago, my grandfather, your Saba's dad, was the captain of a minesweeper in World War II, a big boat out in the ocean, protecting American lives. And when he got back to Seattle after the war, he was an accountant, he had an accounting degree. No one would hire him because he was a Jew. Now, he went and he started his own firm. Okay, and he succeeded, actually. He succeeded quite well. It worked out. And we are privileged. We are lucky. But the white privilege you hear talked about, or you may hear talked about, that tries to invalidate history and who we are and what we are, is wrong. You have a very particular history. You know, 150 years ago, Jews couldn't own land in certain places, and we couldn't travel freely. We couldn't do these things. And we have to recognize the difference and know who we are. And intersectionality and the idea that seeks to erase history and invalidate it should be extremely and especially alarming to those of us who are Jewish and who have a very particular history and an experience that matters and that carries us forward to the underpinnings of where we are and who we are today. The left's linking of these unrelated victimizations, despite tenuous connections, is reflective of a broader trend in hard left politics, whereby increasingly radical activists demand the demonization of Zionists, often used as a euphemism for Jews, be included and featured in the package of causes that must be embraced by anyone claiming the mantle of the label progressive. And that's what exactly makes the form of far-left anti-Semitism so dangerous and so insidious. It's cloaked in the language of progressive idealism, and far more nuanced than the traditional alt-right anti-Semitism. The methodology is clear. Anti-Israel groups are working systematically to infiltrate minority rights organizations, Christian communities, and others, attempting to portray themselves as victims, draw false parallels, and urge those who've had a neutral or open position to Israel to adopt anti-Israel viewpoints. Let me give you a few examples. How many of you have heard of Linda Sarsour? Linda Sarsour is an intersectional feminist and one of the organizers of the Women's March on Washington. She openly supports anti-Muslim groups that tolerate, if not accept, honor killings, the genital mutilation of women. Because of her association with the Women's March and other causes, Sarsour is viewed by many, including the New York Times and Essence and others that put her on the cover, as a legitimate representative of the oppressed and disenfranchised. Here's the truth. Linda Sarsour is an anti-Semite, a BDS supporter. She's posed for photos with Hamas operatives. She praises terrorism. She often uses hashtags like BDS and Free Palestine. And one of her tweets said that nothing is creepier than Zionism. Believe it or not, Sarsour has encouraged Muslims not to engage with or, quote, humanize Israelis. and charged, "There's no room in the feminist movement for those who support Israel's right to exist." Imagine if she had made such comments about anyone else in America, any other minority. The left would be up in arms. But because Jews are increasingly seen or portrayed as privileged and persona non grata among these intersectional movements of the left, Sarsour is celebrated as a heroine of the progressive movement. While her fellow Women's March leader, Tamika Mallory, shamelessly embraces the anti-Semitic leader of the Nation of Islam, Louis Farrakhan. I'm sure I don't have to relate to you the quotes, endless quotes, Louis Farrakhan has said, and just recently, about the devils of the Jews. That's not a progressive stance. It's a fascist one. Similarly, Jewish Voices for Peace, an organization that calls, quote, for an end to violence against civilians and peace and justice for all peoples of the Middle East, invited Rasmia Odeh, a member of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and a convicted terrorist, to appear as a speaker at their national conference. The idea of Odeh, a terrorist who literally has blood on her hands, speaking to a Jewish organization that claims to propagate peace, flies in the face of logic. Yet there are many other examples of radical leftists conflating and linking unrelated grievances. Consider the Black Lives Matter activists who visited Gaza to express solidarity with the terrorist group Hamas. While BLM claims to disavow violence in securing its political objectives, many of its most prominent members are far more eager to criticize, quote, Israeli genocide of Palestinians than criticize Hamas for using rockets to target Israeli civilians, or even mention the hundreds of Israelis who've been murdered in acts of Hamas terrorism. The Black Lives Matter movement blindsided its Jewish supporters with the unveiling of its social and political policy agenda. A far-left manifesto that strays well beyond questions of police brutality and accuses Israel of genocide, apartheid. The strong anti-Israel language stunned progressive Jews, many of whom expressed support for the goals of the Black Lives Matter movement and spoke out against police shootings of unarmed men and other acts of injustice. Again, intersectionality at work. As I said, nowhere has the radical paradigm been more pronounced than on campuses. We tend to think of the problem on campuses as confined to anti-Israel students, but the virus of anti-Semitism and the vilification of Zionism is spreading rapidly among faculty, too. Joy Correga, a professor of rhetoric at Oberlin, one of our country's most prestigious institutions of higher learning, shared a series of Facebook posts claiming that Jews or Israelis control much of the world, were responsible for 9/11 and the Charlie Hebdo attacks in France and the rise of ISIS. One of the posts she shared shortly after the 2015 Charlie Hebdo shooting in France included an image of an ISIS terrorist removing a mask, revealing underneath the face of the Israeli prime minister. The picture includes graphic text implying that the murder of the cartoonist was a false flag conspiracy designed to stop French support for Palestinians. After full court press by multiple pro-Israel organizations, including the Pro-Israel Project, which exposed and then alerted the mainstream media to her work, Correga was removed from the faculty, and the university's president, who initially worked to defend her, was later removed by the Board of Trustees. I wish I could tell you this was an isolated case. It's not. Earlier this month, it emerged that Professor Chaney Lippold of the American Culture Department at the University of Michigan refused to write a letter of recommendation for a student because she said she would be studying in Israel. His note to her, you may have seen it, said, "When I agreed to write your recommendation, I didn't realize you were planning to travel to Israel. I withdraw my offer. Let me know if you'd like to travel somewhere else. I'd be happy to write you a recommendation." These are just two examples. The problem is quite serious, and we need to work together to address it. We also need to do more to support pro-Israel students who are fighting on the battle lines. But remember, campus is a microcosm. It's a reflection of broader communications and ideas and trends that are out there. Intersectional feminists and gay rights activists refusing to condemn pervasive sexism, homophobia in the Arab world is not just ironic or hypocritical. It's insane. As we all know, anyone who is truly on the side of human justice, human progress, human dignity should stand with us in fighting against those on the anti-Zionist left who are manipulating well-intentioned people into perpetrating the hatred of the most oppressed people in history. Increasingly, these radical elements try and force other progressives to embrace a variety of causes, again, how unrelated they may be, as long as they condemn Israel. If that doesn't scare you, then all you need to do is take a close look at what's taking place across the Atlantic to see where all this can lead. In Britain, the stakes have never been higher for the Jewish community. British Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn's relentless obsession with Israel has created a dangerous climate. Apathy, perhaps, towards anti-Semitism in the country? Maybe generous. The problem is serious enough that recent polling suggests 40% of British Jews will seriously consider leaving the country if he's elected prime minister. By deliberately blurring the lines between anti-Semitism and legitimate criticism of Israel, the Corbyn effect has shaken British Jewry to its core, with an impact felt well beyond the borders of England. In fact, the rhetoric deployed by Corbyn and his supporters is remarkably similar to the language used by the BDS movement against Israel and by the same activists here in the United States who are part of the far-left branch of the party, the Democratic Party. Momentum, as his supporters are called, have their corollary here too. These boycotters advocate for an open, full Palestinian right of return from river to the sea, which is code word for the one-state solution and the destruction of Israel. In an article for the website Mondo Weiss, a prominent BDS supporter in England wrote, quote, "The Holocaust has been employed shamelessly by Israel, and the extermination of European Jewry shamelessly by Israel of European Jewry is a principal argument that is used to justify the creation of the state of Israel. The Holocaust has been employed shamelessly by Israel, and the extermination of European Jewry is the principal argument that is used to justify the creation of the state of Israel." I was in Cleveland recently, and they had a controversy there where they allowed Elon Pop, one of the world's foremost historical revisionists, to speak. He got up and said that the idea of Zionism was not created by the Jews, but was created by anti-Semitic Christian theologians in Europe in the 1700s, who invented Zionism as a way to get rid of the Jews from Europe. There's an effort to delegitimize the story and history of Judaism as much as there's an effort at the moment to delegitimize and undermine the definition of anti-Semitism, and we'll get to that too. Then there's Corbyn's own flirtation with anti-Semitism itself, and it's not unrelated. At a 2013 event hosted by the Palestine Return Center, he compared Israelis to Nazis, and later participated in a controversial wreath-laying at a ceremony in Tunisia at the grave of a terrorist behind the Munich massacre of Israeli athletes. Corbyn also claimed that British-born Jews fail to be English. He recently said that Zionists and Jews have clearly two problems, a quote. One is they don't want to study history. And secondly, having lived in this country, England, for a very long time, probably all their lives, they don't understand English irony either. Activist Yehuda Jeswich, who desecrated the walls of the Warsaw Ghetto with Free Gaza and Free Palestine graffiti, Corbyn has described as his very good friend. He reserves similar words for Hamas and Hezbollah. When the Labour Party moved to pass the European Union, United States, and internationally recognized definition of anti-Semitism recently, after its controversies, Corbyn himself sought to introduce an amendment that would authorize people to say that Israel's foundation was a racist endeavor, and that that would not violate the definition of anti-Semitism somehow. Of course it does. This should be a major concern to all of us. The Corbyn effect has parachuted extremely anti-Jewish and anti-Israel sentiments from obscure fringes of the political spectrum into the mainstream. That virus has already reached the shores of the United States, and it is a disease that is metastasizing too rapidly. The hijacking of progressive ideals by anti-Semites is outrageous, and I'm alarmed that anti-Semitism appears no longer a marginal problem on the left, and that candidates are espousing such views, climbing the ranks within the party which historically has been the natural home to Jews. If you think I'm exaggerating, then think about Ilhan Omar. Ilhan Omar is a state representative in Minnesota. She will be elected to the state house shortly. She'll replace Keith Ellison. She'll be the first Somali woman ever elected to Congress. She's being celebrated widely. She recently said, "Israel has hypnotized the world. May Allah awaken people and help them see the evil doings of Israel," which she describes as satanic. Ms. Omar is all but certain to win a congressional seat in November. In San Diego, the Democratic candidate for Congress is the grandson of the man who organized the Munich massacres. There are others. This trend can't be allowed to continue. Make a mistake, we are seeing a war for the definition of what it means to be progressive, and we can't afford to lose. Now, the complex issues I've laid out tonight are as complex as they're disturbing, and our community searches for an answer, and I want to leave you with some things to think about. And I'm happy to answer any questions that we have as we move into our next session. First, I want to ask you all the question, not to be answered now. I'd like you to think about it, something I'd like you to think about in a quiet moment. Do our own prejudices factor into the equation as we search for an effective response to the problem? Let me put it another way. How many of you were disturbed by President Trump's silence in the wake of Charlottesville? And more disturbed than you were at finding out that the two leaders of the Women's March on Washington, Linda Sarsour and Tamika Mallory, are hardcore anti-Semites who believe in Hamas and despise Israel and Jews? That's an uncomfortable question, I imagine, but it needs to be asked. Because our enemies on both the left and the right would like nothing more than to see us fight amongst ourselves. It's called divide and conquer, and it's happening right before our eyes. It's easy to vilify someone or something you already dislike, but what happens when your allies and your friends, some of whom you may agree with on just about every other issue, suddenly attack Israel unfairly, or speak about Israel as it shouldn't exist, or behave in a way that you think is anti-Semitic? Just imagine how difficult it is for Jewish youth. More and more young Jews are becoming alienated from Israel. Jews who question Israel's current path, settlement building, the nation-state law, are often vilified by those on the right. Those who support Israel's positions on the right can be made to be feel uncomfortable by those on the left, called names equally. And those positions can be made uncomfortable all around. Many opt out of the conversation for this reason. There are also many older ones of us that are extremely concerned about the path is on and where things will lead without change. Having said that, we need to remind ourselves as a community to respect the right of Israelis to make their own decisions and elect their own governments. The cult of personality is a powerful one, but the U.S.-Israel relationship works because of shared values and shared interests and because of a broad consensus among Americans of all backgrounds and all faiths and all political perspectives that Israel is an important friend and ally. And as our enemies aim to undermine and weaken and destroy that consensus, we have to keep a few things in mind. People among us may have strong feelings about Benjamin Netanyahu or President Trump, but that has to be irrelevant to their support for Israel. There is only one Israel. We don't get the luxury of being supportive one year and not the next. Friends are friends on sunny days and rainy days. Half or more of the Israeli public voted against Benjamin Netanyahu in the last election. And yet Israel still needs foreign aid. It still needs Iron Dome to protect its population against rockets and missiles. It still needs our support as the UN gangs up on it to counter the unremitting assault on the Jewish state. Predicating all of your support one's support on Israel over the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as Dan Shapiro, my friend and colleague and former ambassador to Israel, said, is a major mistake for Jews and for others. Or because Bibi wins elections and because politicians from the left to the right agree when the president says Jerusalem is Israel's capital and won't condemn him, or agree and support the idea from Labor and Kadima and Likud and across the spectrum that opening the embassy in Jerusalem is the right thing to do. While the rest of the world is busy telling the worst version of truth blended with lies, the left in this country is making Jewish children uncomfortable in their own skin, not because of the reality in Israel, but because people here won't call out the lies from our own politically driven community too often. I think when we blame Israelis and Israel for the fact that their politicians won't speak out in ways that sound to us like we want them to sound when it comes to domestic American issues, it's more about us than it is about them. I love and support both countries, and it doesn't always mean that I agree with the political decisions of those or those who get elected. Calling out anti-Semitism among your enemies is important, but calling it out amongst your friends is also critical. For me, the hardest thing is to say nothing, and silence means approval, so I won't be silent. That's why I do what I do. That's why the Israel Project does what it does. We fight for truth with facts. We ensure that stories about Israel aren't poisoned by the lies and anti-Semitic innuendo peddled by those seeking to delegitimize and destroy Israel. We speak out, but we can't do it alone. Last week, there was an article in the New York Times about a man named Ken Marcus. Ken Marcus is a good guy. He ran something called the Brandeis Center in Washington. It's engendered to ensure that Jewish college students, when they go to college, don't have that pit in their stomach, that feeling of nervousness, because they're getting spit on or yelled at or harassed for being pro-Israel. And as you know, on campuses, the intimidation tactics that are being used by anti-Israel groups are intensifying in their efforts. The New York Times, so Ken is now an appointee to the Department of Education. And the New York Times wrote an article about his appointment, and in the article it referred to him as, quote, an opponent of Palestinian rights. And it described this EU definition of anti-Semitism, which was adopted in 2005 and has been used by the United States State Department and our entire government since 2007 and was adopted by 35 countries around the world a couple of years ago. He describes, in the article, frames this definition as highly contested, hotly contested and highly controversial. Two different places. So I called my friend who's the bureau chief of the New York Times in Washington. She was on vacation in Nantucket. We spoke for a while, and then she said, why don't you call Jonathan Wiseman? He's the editor in Washington who's on duty. And I did. I called Jonathan, and he's an expert in his mind about this. He wrote a book called Semitism in the Age of Trump. You may have seen it. It's got parentheses around the word Semitism. And I said, John, you know, I wanted to ask about this piece because you and I know Ken. I don't know. Is he an opponent of Palestinian rights? Well, he says, if you look at the actions he took on campus, it was the effect was to restrict the work of Palestinian rights groups. And I said, well, is his effort to ensure that Jewish students on campus aren't harassed or intimidated or bullied by those groups an effort to infringe on their rights or to protect civil discourse? Well, he hemmed and hawed. I said, look, I don't want to fight with you about the technicalities of it. I just think, you know, I believe your job is to not to mislead. The mission is not to mislead. And I think when you describe someone like Ken like that, it leaves a misimpression of him for your readers. He said, okay, I'll think about that. Great. I said, I want to talk about the definition of anti-Semitism, which, by the way, is under attack. It's under attack because we helped lead an effort to get 25 states to pass legislation that says if you're a company that does it participates in a boycott of Israel. You break these rules, we're not going to do business with you with our pension fund. And that definition is important for understanding and judging people's conduct. Today there's a war against that definition. Who do you think opposes the definition of anti-Semitism? I'll give you a clue. People who want to keep violating it. So I said to him, well, it's controversial among whom? Silence. I said, this definition was approved by the European Union in 2005. It's hotly contested. The framing of things matters. The reason I tell you that story as an aside is because how we frame, how the media frames these ideas matters to us. Because the effort to undermine the legitimacy of the definition of anti-Semitism is a problem. Is comparing Israel to Nazis anti-Semitic? How about comparing Israel to ISIS? Israel was worse than ISIS. How about accusing Israel of committing genocide against Palestinians? If we don't enforce the standards, places like the Cleveland City Club, which has hosted every presidential candidate that I know of, where Eric Garcetti went a couple weeks ago to launch his campaign, one word short of launching it, will feel free to host people like Elon Pop, who says all of those things, because they don't really see evidence of, as they said, we don't see evidence of anti-Semitism where others have found it, until I went to them with the definition and then said, here, Madam President, does this meet it? And then they remove from their statement the thing that said, we see no evidence of this, but we draw the line of hate speech. So then the question was, well, is anti-Semitism hate speech? And they went forward with the event anyway, in the middle of the Friday between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Okay? Now their board has understood the controversy, and I think maybe they'll adopt the definition, and they'll use it to judge their partners in their conduct. But if we don't stand up and say something, if we're silent in the face of the problem, why would we expect any different? That's why we do what we do. We speak out, but we can't do it alone. And I'll tell you why. The ADL, and I respect Jonathan and the ADL, say there are more people running for elected office in this country today who espouse anti-Semitic views than ever. In fact, in 2017, we saw a 60% increase in acts of assault, harassment, vandalism against Jews and Jewish institutions. That must change, and we can no longer afford the luxury of being silent because it makes us uncomfortable to speak out and disagree with people we care about or with whom we share other common initiatives. Did you know, for instance, that according to the FBI statistics, religiously motivated hate crimes against Jews are almost 6 out of 10? Does anyone know what the next closest group is? It's Muslims. Do you know what the number is? Less than 2 out of 10. After all the years. One of the things I struggle with every day is how to talk to my children about this, to encourage them to be proud of their heritage and identity, but also understand why some people will always dislike them. And here's what I say. Jews have faced and continue to face enormous obstacles just to be treated like everyone else. We've confronted anti-Semitism in the United States, college quotas, workplace discrimination, bigotry, and overseas, inability to own land, prohibition from living in certain cities, the Pale of Settlement, and on. Even so, we've persisted, we have survived, and more. Jewish thought and Jewish innovation provided the bedrock for Western civilization. Human dignity, the rule of law, property rights, protecting Western civilization. We were the longest surviving refugees in history, an aboriginal people. The Jews are the original aboriginal people who were expelled from our homeland, the land of Israel, and hounded for centuries until the creation of the modern Jewish state. In other words, Zionism is the original national liberation movement. 100 years ago, Jews were being slaughtered in pogroms. 75 years ago, in the gas chambers. But 70 years ago, we threw off the colonial yoke, the British, but also by extension, imperial powers, that ruled our homeland since Rome. How cool is that? We're history's greatest survivors. We've got a lot to be proud of. And by persisting and fighting for our values and our contributions to Western society and human civilization, they've been immense. And in achieving our rebirth and the development of the State of Israel, we've led the way for other oppressed peoples around the world. We are a success story that they can emulate, resisting centuries of hate and discrimination and repression by the world's privileged groups and ultimately overcoming them. That's a narrative, a story, a reality, a history that we must get our children to embrace and to realize. It's so amazing and so inspiring to be part of a people, the Jewish people, who have faced and overcome the worst hate mongers the world could conceive, but have now prevailed over oppression and hate to liberate our own homeland and to give so much to so many others who suffer such a difficult fate today. And yet we still face the hate of the neo-Nazi right and of the anti-Semitic, anti-Zionist left. Now, we are still working to make the world a better place to advance human justice in America and around the world, and in Israel, and even despite the disagreements of the Palestinians, who continue to deny Jewish people's aboriginal rights and ties to the homeland, we stand tall. Our kids should be immensely proud of the fact that they're part of that, and they should have this pride and understanding and the ammunition and the wherewithal to stand up and tell their story and fight back against intersectionality. That doesn't mean we have to condone or every action we see. But it does mean that when we hear people cross the line, we need to stand up and say something. Jews are human justice campaigners on a multi-millennial scale. We have been fighting privilege and oppression for centuries, and we still are. All who are truly on the side of human justice should stand with us in fighting against those, the anti-Zionist left, and those who are manipulating well-intentioned people into perpetuating a hatred of the most oppressed people in history. Our fate is in our hands, but we have to fight for it. No one is going to fight for us, and no one will speak out for us. We need to rise to the occasion and raise our voices. As we have in the past, today is no different. No different except we've learned one thing. The price of silence. Thank you very much.